without any shadow of doubt, Jesus was one of the central figures of history. After all, I checked it out on Wikipedia, so it must be true, about one in every three people in the world today claims to be a Christian. And Jesus is, of course, the central figure of Christianity. So one in three people in the world claim to be followers of Jesus. Nobody else can say that of themselves, that one in three people in the world follow me. Equally certain is that Jesus' death is at the center of Christianity. For example, what we call the Lord's Supper or communion is at the very heart of Christian worship. And the Lord's Supper is a way of remembering the death of Jesus. Or take another example. We have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which tell us all about Jesus. And they all very clearly focus on the days leading up to his death itself, and then his resurrection. So if you put all that evidence together, it is clear not only that Jesus is one of the central figures of history, but that Jesus' death is one of the central events of history, one of those events which has done more than any other to shape the human race in the last 2,000 years. It's also clear that Jesus didn't die from natural causes. It's clear for a variety of reasons that Jesus was killed, that he was executed by crucifixion. But why? Why was Jesus killed? In our studies in the book of Luke, we've come to this account of Jesus' trial and how he was condemned to die by the Roman governor Pilate. But Luke doesn't just want to simply tell us that, well, Jesus had a trial and then he was condemned to death and then he died. Luke clearly wants us to be clear why it happened. So we need to look at this passage, and this is what we're going to do this morning, asking the question, why was Jesus killed? And Luke makes it crystal clear that there were two reasons why Jesus was killed. So I simply have 2 points this morning, looking at those two reasons. But then we need to look at where this leaves us. Okay, so the first reason why Jesus was killed because that was the will of wicked human beings. Jesus was killed because that was the will of wicked human beings. It was the Roman governor Pilate who actually gave the instruction that Jesus should be killed. Humanly speaking, he was the one who had the power to authorize his execution. But the passage makes clear that when he does so, what he's actually doing is giving in to the demand of the Jewish leaders and the Jewish people. Because if you look at verses 24-25, the last two verses of our passage, so Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who was thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they had asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. Now, if we ask, well, hang on, who's Luke talking about when he talks about their demand and their will in those two verses? Then the group it's referring to are introduced back in verse 13, where we read, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. The people who demand Jesus' death, the people whose will is submitted to when he's handed over to death, are the religious leaders, the political leaders, and the people of the Jewish nation. The whole nation is gathered to tell Pilate what they think should be Jesus' fate. This is one of those occasions. It happens to take place at Passover time when Jews travel from the four corners of the earth to be in Jerusalem. So they were, as it were, representatives of the whole nation, and they say, we want Jesus to be killed. But why? We can say, why was Jesus killed? Well, of course, the Jews wanted him to be, but why? Well, to answer that question, we need to split that group into two parts. Look at the leaders first, and then at the people later. And we need to go back to the beginning of the passage. Jesus was arrested in the middle of the night, the Thursday night. We looked at that passage last week. He was taken from the Mount of Olives, that hill just outside Jerusalem, where he was arrested. He was taken to the house of the high priest, to the Archbishop of Canterbury, shall we say, the chief religious figure in the nation. Some sort of preliminary cross-examination took place there during the night. You can read all about that in Mark's Gospel and Matthew's Gospel. The Jewish religious authorities were trying to find out what would going to be the most favorable line of accusation by which they could accuse Jesus. Luke doesn't tell us of the details of that sort of preliminary trial, but this is all taking place in the background, in the high priest's house, while out in the courtyard, out there in that cold spring night, Peter is huddling with the others around the fire. And Peter is then repeatedly denying that he knows Jesus. When that preliminary cross-examination by the Jewish leaders has come to an end, Jesus is left in the hands of the temple guards, the soldiers who are under the control of the Jewish religious authorities. And verses 63 to 65, the first paragraph, tell us how they abused him. First thing in the morning, the Jewish leaders convene a meeting of the entire Jewish council. This is the body of people who must come to the official verdict on behalf of the Jews. And Jesus is brought before this group, verse 66. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council. Now, they've already done the spade work, as it were. They've worked out what are going to be the most promising lines of inquiry. And so as the council meets, they go to the heart of the matter. And it all centers on who Jesus is. Beginning of verse 67, if you are the Christ, tell us. They start by asking Jesus, are you the Christ? Are you that Messiah? Are you the King who hundreds of years earlier, back in the Old Testament, God had promised would come and rescue Israel? What's Jesus' answer? Well, his answer's in two parts. The first, the end of verse 67, he said to them, if I tell you, you'll not believe, and if I ask you, you will not answer. And Jesus sees, and he's seeing this from the preliminary trial, they're not interested in the answer. They're not really interested in, is Jesus the Christ? Is he the Messiah? They're not interested in genuinely examining the evidence. They've already made up their minds that he can't possibly be the Christ. So Jesus says, look, it's pointless me answering your question. So here's the first thing we need to know. These Jewish leaders aren't interested in the truth. They aren't interested in the evidence. They've already determined that they want Jesus out of the way, come what may. The truth is not the issue. The issue for them is, how can we get him convicted? So instead of answering their question, Jesus chooses to make his own statement about who he is, verse 69. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. Jesus is using a title that he's picked up from the prophecy of Daniel, Son of Man, and he's using a role that he'll be seated at the right hand of the power of God, that is a role that's described in Psalm 110. If you just look briefly at those, firstly in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, I saw in the night vision Daniel has, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man, that title, and he came to the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. He said, from now on, you're actually going to see me reigning over the entire universe. And Psalm 110, verse 1, the Lord, that's God, says to my Lord, this is David speaking, so he's saying, the Lord God says to my Lord, the Messiah, the King, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Your right-hand man was your most important man. And that was the imagery. So God is saying to Jesus, sit at my right hand until, again, all your enemies are defeated. Jesus is saying, I'm about to be killed, but actually what I'm about to become beyond the death lies my resurrection and exaltation to God's right hand. I'm going to reign over the entire universe and I'm going to judge the nations. Now, for the Jewish leaders back in Luke, this is an idea they are completely unwilling even to think about, because this makes Jesus more or less equal with God. Yes, they're right, it does. And for them, such an idea is blasphemy. But of course, it's true. Luke in his gospel has presented lots and lots and lots of evidence that this is indeed exactly who Jesus is. But the Jewish leaders, they're just not interested. Now, why? Why were they really offended by this idea that the promised Messiah they'd been, in theory, waiting for, who the Old Testament made clear would be God himself, why are they not interested when he actually arrives? Why won't they believe the evidence? Well, the reality was that Jesus was a rival for them. Before Jesus had come, people looked up to them as the religious teachers and leaders. The Jewish leaders hate the truth because to accept it would be too costly for them. For them, truth takes second place to personal ambition. So Jesus was killed because that was the will of wicked human beings. Why? Because he is in the way of their personal ambition. Now, we've got to apply this to ourselves. This isn't just a history lesson. So let's go through the questions again. Why was Jesus killed? Because it was the will of wicked human beings. Why did those human beings want him killed? Well, one reason was because he got in the way of their personal ambition. That was true of the Jewish religious leaders. But are we any different? Why do people oppose Jesus today? Answer, for exactly the same reason. The Jewish leaders like to be the ones who are in charge. A Jesus who claimed to be God's appointed king, who demanded obedience in every area of life, was an unwanted rival who needed to be got out of the way of. But that is not unique to them. That is the very heart of sinful human nature. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. What was Adam and Eve's sin? They wanted to be God. They didn't want God to be in charge. They wanted to be able to make decisions for themselves about what was right and wrong. So the challenge for us this morning is, do you see that in you? The Jewish leaders were the ones who happened to be there at the time, but they were really just doing the dirty work for all of us. The truth about human nature, the universal truth about human nature, the truth about every man, woman, and child on this planet is that we are born with the same attitude of the Jewish leaders. We want to get rid of Jesus because he gets in the way of our personal ambition. The ambition to be in charge of our own lives. Now hold on to that thought. We'll come back there in a minute. But let's complete the picture by turning now to the crowd. The Jewish council have arrived at their decision. Their desire is to have Jesus executed. It's justified in their minds, but they lack the power to carry it out because they live in an occupied country and capital offences had to be dealt with by the Romans. So off they traipse. They go and see Pilate, who is the Roman governor. But Pilate won't be interested in whether Jesus claims to be God or not. So they take a different tack. They must portray Jesus as politically dangerous, as a rival to the power of Caesar. So verse 2 of chapter 23, they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation, forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." They're making out that he's guilty of insurrection, sort of political rebellion against the government, against the Romans. The whole idea is complete nonsense. Jesus very clearly is not a political revolutionary. He'd even said just a few days earlier, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but to God the things that are God's." It doesn't take Pilate long to see through the whole thing. Jesus is obviously not trying to overthrow the Romans. Verse 4, Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But the chief priests won't accept the verdict. They keep coming back with more challenges throughout the passage, time and time again. It's like a sort of, it's almost like one of these sort of pantomimes. Oh, yes, he is. Oh, no, he isn't. They keep saying, oh, yes, he's guilty. And Pilate says, oh, no, he isn't. Time and time again, he says that Jesus doesn't done nothing deserving of death. Verse 13, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, you brought this man to me as one who is misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I do not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. And verse 20, Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. And verse 22, a third time he said to them, why, what evil has he done? I found in him no guilt deserving death. Now, again, another question. Why doesn't Pilate just ignore the Jewish leaders? After all, he's in charge. He's the Roman governor. Well, this is where the crowd come in. In the early part of the chapter, it's the religious leaders who are taking the lead. But as the morning goes on, another group become more and more prominent, the crowds. Verse 13, Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. And verse 18, but they all cried together, away with this man. And verse 21, but they, this is the crowd, kept shouting, crucify, crucify him. Verse 23, but they, the whole crowd, were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified. The crowds are insistent that Jesus be crucified and that a man called Barabbas, who has committed murder and who has started an insurrection, a political riot, uprising, they're insistent that he should be released. Now, this changes things for Pilate. This is Passover time of year. There are vast crowds of Jews gathered in Jerusalem. It was the time of year when the Jews remembered how they gained freedom from the Egyptians all those centuries ago. It was a time when Jewish emotions ran high. It was a time when the mood could be very volatile. And the last thing Pilate wants is a riot on his hands. So in the end, he takes the politically expedient decision. Rather have one man killed unjustly than have a major riot on your hands. After all, the emperor wouldn't be very impressed if a riot happened on my watch. Now, that all adds up. But hold on a minute. Why did the crowds want Jesus killed? This is Friday morning. Earlier in the week, even yesterday morning, Thursday morning, the Jewish leaders were afraid to arrest Jesus in case that started a riot because Jesus was so popular with the crowds. How has there been such a dramatic change of opinion within 24 hours? Thursday morning, the crowds are gathering in the temple to hear Jesus preach. Friday morning, they're calling for him to be crucified. Now, why is that? Well, it's clear from the Gospels that the crowd's liking for Jesus was because they thought he would be the sort of king they wanted. One who would free them from the Romans. They had a clear agenda for Jesus. But it's equally clear from the Gospels that Jesus has no intention of being that sort of king. And when it becomes clear to the crowds that Jesus isn't going to overthrow the Romans, why, look, here he is. He's been arrested by them. Then they turn against him, as much out of angry disappointment as anything else. You haven't done what we want. You haven't used your power to fulfill our agenda. Jesus, you can raise the dead. Jesus, you can heal the sick. Jesus, you can calm the storm. Jesus, why won't you use your power to get rid of the Romans like we want you to? Jesus, you've let us down, so we hate you. So why was Jesus killed? Well, in the case of the leaders, it was because he was in the way of their personal ambition. In the case of the crowds, it was because he refuses to carry out their agenda. Again, we must apply that to us. See, the crowd had their agenda of what Jesus should do, get rid of the Romans, make us healthy and wealthy. If Jesus had done those things, they would have carried on cheering for him. But when Jesus' agenda was something different, you need to repent. You need to ask for forgiveness. You need to be more concerned about where you spend eternity than what happens to you down here. They weren't interested in that. And are things much different today? Preach a message that Jesus will make you healthy and wealthy, that Jesus will sort out all your problems as you perceive them down here. You'll have plenty of people listening and following you. But tell people that Jesus' agenda is that they're sinners who need forgiveness, and that Jesus has come to bring them trials and difficulties in this life, but a home in heaven for all eternity. That is a disappointment to many. More than that, it's more than a disappointment. It makes many people angry because Jesus isn't buying into their agenda. So I ask you the question this morning. The passage asks you the question. Are you angry with Jesus because he doesn't do what you want him to do? I'm not bothered about sins. I'm not bothered about heaven. I want you to make me comfortable down here, Jesus. And so Jesus has to be done away with. The Jews need the help of a Pilate who is too feeble to stand up to the crowd. They need the help of a Herod who is too frivolous to take issues of truth and justice seriously. And they get that. For the passage ends with their will being done. Verse 25, but he, Pilate, delivered Jesus over to their will. Pilate says to the crowd, not my will, but yours be done. That is why Jesus was killed. But that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Haven't we heard something like that before? Not my will, but yours be done. Yes, we did last week in chapter 22, verse 42. Jesus prays in the garden, saying, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. So firstly, Jesus was killed because that was the will of wicked human beings. Secondly, Jesus was killed according to the will of God. See, on the Mount of Olives, Jesus prays, not my will, prays to God the Father, not my will, but yours be done. Was that prayer answered? Was the will of God done? Surely it was the will of sinful people that was done. We've just seen that. But Luke assures us that it was also the will of God that was done. It was also the will of God that Jesus was killed, but for very different reasons than the will of the people. And there are three clues I just want to point out to you in today's passage as to why Jesus was killed according to the will of God. Firstly, Jesus dies as an innocent man. As we read through today's passage, I'm sure one of the first things that struck you was the repeated verdict of Pilate, backed up by Herod, that Jesus had done nothing deserving of death. They were the ones in whose hands was the law of the land. They were the secular authorities. They were the ones responsible for pronouncing the legal verdict. And the message is repeated time and time again. Verse 4, I find no guilt in this man. End of verse 14 and verse 15. I do not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him, neither did Herod. Verse 22, I have found no guilt deserving death. Now, of course, Pilate is speaking only of the charge of insurrection that he was presented with. But what Pilate says is more true than he realizes. In a very literal sense, Jesus has done nothing deserving of death. Every single one of us has broken God's commands, and so the Bible makes clear every single one of us has done things deserving of death. But Jesus was perfect. Jesus alone, out of all the human beings who ever lived on this planet, has done nothing deserving of death. Jesus dies as an innocent man. Then secondly, Jesus, the innocent man, dies in the place of Barabbas, a guilty man. The crimes that Jesus is accused of, misleading the nation, forbidding them from paying tribute to Caesar, claiming to be a king, if proved, would amount to insurrection in the eyes of the Romans, a political rebellion, uprising against the Roman government. Jesus is repeatedly declared innocent, and yet was punished as though he was guilty of those crimes. On the other hand, in prison was a man called Barabbas, who was guilty of insurrection and murder. He had committed crimes that in the eyes of the Romans deserved death. And yet Barabbas, a guilty man, was set free as though he was innocent. This comes out very clearly, very, very clearly in the last verse of the passage, verse 25. Pilate released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but delivered Jesus over to their will. Luke wants us to see that it is as though Jesus takes the punishment that Barabbas deserves, and that Barabbas gains the freedom that Jesus deserves. But in that sense, Barabbas is just an example of a much wider and even more profound truth, because the third thing Luke wants us to see in this passage is that Jesus dies in the place of sinners. The exchange of places between Jesus and Barabbas is a perfect picture of what is going on when Jesus is killed. Back in 22:42, the thing that Jesus submits to as he prays is drinking this cup. Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will but yours be done. Jesus accepts that he's going to drink the cup. That cup was the cup of God's wrath against sinners. That is God's will for him that Jesus submits to. Jesus is killed because he is taking the punishment of guilty people like you and me so that we might escape the punishment that we deserve. What happens between Jesus and Barabbas over dying for the charge of insurrection against the Romans happens between Jesus and every Christian over the charge of insurrection against God. For we, so to speak, are all on death row. We're in prison, guilty of the worst crime of all, rising up not against King Caesar, but arising up against King God, who made us, trying to topple him from his throne and trying to put ourselves in his place. We deserve to die for insurrection. But Jesus, who has always lived in perfect obedience to his Father, dies in our place, in the place of a sinner like you or I, so that we might go free. Perhaps there's even a play on words in the name of Barabbas. His name literally means son of the Father. Jesus, the eternal Son of God, dies so that sinners like us can become sons and daughters of the Father. Why did Jesus die? Because certainly it was the will of the wicked human beings that he did so. Pilate said that. Not my will, but yours be done, he said to the Jewish people. But wonderfully, it was also because of the will of God. Wonderfully, because that will was that Jesus, the innocent man, died in the place of guilty people like us, taking the punishment we deserved that we might go free. It happened because Jesus also said, not my will, but yours be done. But he said it to God the Father. Acts 2, verse 23 sums up the fact that it's these two things happening simultaneously. This Jesus, Peter speaking to Jews, delivered up according to the deliberate plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. But Luke hasn't just written the end of chapter 22 as we have it and first half of chapter 23 so that we can understand why Jesus was killed. He's also challenging us where we stand. One writer sums it up well. He says that there are two plans, that of wicked people with Satan behind them and that of God. And he puts it like this. He says, those two plans converge at Calvary. But the difference between them is all important, and men must choose on whose side they will be. Either beneficiaries of the plan by which God brought Jesus to the cross, or accomplices in the plan by which Satan brought him there. So whose side are you on? Naturally, we're all on Satan's side. That's the situation we're born in. We want Jesus out of the way, but you can change. So this is the question this morning. Are you going to carry on being opposed to Jesus because he is a threat to your personal ambition? Or because he fails to meet your agenda? Do you agree with the Jewish leaders and the people who want him killed? Because I want to be in charge of my life. And Jesus has failed to do what I want him to do. You know, there's a saying, isn't it? I forget who said it. If there is a God, he'd better have a good excuse. Which is saying, God, you haven't done what we human beings want. You haven't made our lives pleasant and comfortable in the way we want them to be. That's the Jewish people, of which we're all naturally lined up with. Or will you, on the other hand, recognize that Jesus was killed according to the will of God, dying as an innocent man in your place, you who are a guilty man or woman, dying so that you might be forgiven, dying so that you might become a child of the Father, a child of God? Will you change sides? It's a vital decision. Because as Jesus tells us at the beginning of the passage, beyond his death lies his resurrection and his exaltation to that place reigning, that place where he will come again as judge. From now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. As that first generation of Jews discovered, you can't get rid of Jesus. Even if you kill him, he comes back to life. Even if you kill him, as it were, in your life and say, Jesus, I'm chucking you out of my life, there I've got rid of you. I'm afraid he'll come back again. You will have to face him one day. What will you be on that day? Will you be a beneficiary of his death? Jesus died there for me. Or will you be an accomplice in his death? Yes, I wanted throughout my life, I maintained that attitude, I wanted Jesus out of the way. I appeal to you. I don't know where you all stand. But I appeal to you to humbly recognize that Jesus died. Jesus was killed so that you could be forgiven. And to call on you to give up your rebellion. Why was Jesus killed? I long for each of you to be able to go away this morning and say the answer is Jesus was killed to pay for my sins. He died in my place so that I might go free, so that I might be a Barabbas. I was locked up, as it were, ready to face the death penalty, because that's what I deserved before God. But then the wonderful news came that another man had died in my place, and I was set free. And now I've got to live for him for the rest of my life.